I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Thought we'd talk a little bit today about the South China Sea. We've talked about it before, but there's been a change with the U.S. having a presence now. Austin, you wrote about a U.S. Guided missile destroyer selling into the South China Sea, and I know that the Chinese have responded, and they said they're not afraid to go to war with us. So,
well, that's basically what they said. I called the USS Lassen's rather short cruise provocative. Another senior Chinese leader talked about it as aggression. They said they would respond, and then the Pentagon said these patrols, as they called them, will continue. But what the Lassen was doing was, the Navy has a term for it, even though we really ought to have Al Nofi on here to talk about all the Navy's acronyms, FONOP, Freedom of Navigation operation, which we run all the time, and I pointed that out in the column. Interestingly enough, I read the Wall Street Journal's essay this morning, and they made this point that I made in my column as well. Last year, the United States Navy ran 19 of these. We do them all the time. And as for sailing through the South China Sea is one of the most heavily trafficked sea routes in the world. We do it all the time. The problem is now is that China has built these artificial islands, taking what are called sea features, or sometimes underwater or low tide features. There are a number of names for them, but think of reefs that are barely submerged, and then they turn them into artificial islands, and then add airfields. So essentially, they become aircraft carriers, Dan. Aircraft carriers extending several hundred to a couple of thousand, they're approaching that, 1,500 kilometers south of the Chinese mainland, in water that is claimed, territorial waters, areas that are claimed by the Philippines, Vietnam. They even approach Asia, Malaysia, and Brunei. And the only, as I pointed out, the only country that doesn't seem to have a problem with China doing this is Cambodia, which has become a sort of a wholly owned subsidiary of China. That's not exactly right, but there's at least foreign policy wise, it's a kowtow nation to Beijing. And so what we have is the U.S. Navy, in an act of what I call muscular diplomacy, because there have been several attempts, and even though my column talks about it 4 or 5 years of getting serious on this, you can see a line of U.S. Comments to China about its behavior in the South China Sea that go back almost 2 decades. Lower-level diplomatic contacts, comments from U.S. Navy officers to Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy officers. I still think they're called the Plan, aren't they, Jim? Isn't that right?
Yeah.
They changed their name. Yeah. Okay. So that's I got that right. Comments that are diplomatic. There's lower level to try to keep it from rising to a higher level, because China has been fencing with its Southeast Asian neighbors over these islands. Really, look, 1974, it took an island from then South Vietnam, and it's one that Vietnam still complains about, says that it's rightfully theirs. That's in the Paracels, which is in the northern South China Sea. They've been fencing with the Filipinos seriously since the late 1980s. It got hot in the 1990s, and that's part of when you start seeing the U.S., a reaction to China, because even though the Filipinos wanted the U.S. Navy out of Subic Bay, which now seem to regret, and there were all the quote unquote frictions over quote unquote colonialism between the U.S. and the Philippines, Philippines and the U.S. are allies, and the games that China was playing now in the Spratlys, which is further south in the South China Sea, intruded into what the Filipinos, and this is my opinion, Dan, but it's also the opinion of a lot of historians, other historians and cartographers, and what has been regarded as Filipino waters since the 17th century. The Filipinos can produce a couple of 17th century maps that show that. And the Chinese have one they claim comes from the 10th century, but this little map war, which we've discussed before on the strategy page, it does not favor China by any stretch. What favors China is all of its money and its expanding military power and its ability to create these islands. And notice, remember I said that they have air bases. They do look like aircraft carriers to me, stationary aircraft carriers. China's operational line or strategic line is the nine dash line, which dips way down south in the South China Sea. It's kind of a irregular parabola going dipping down to Borneo. They claim that area. That they asserted the claim, I want to say 2012 or 2013, that it was Chinese territorial water, suddenly incorporating almost, I think it was right at 2 million square kilometers of sea area, and then went quiet about it. As Jim has said in the past, this is typical of the way the Chinese act when they're in an imperial phase, whether it's in the 21st century or the 7th century. They will make a claim and then go quiet and wait and see whatever everybody else does. But that's pretty aggressive diplomacy on Beijing's part. And if I got the year wrong, I'm within I'm within shouting distance, because they have made the made that claim. Besides building these islands, they've conducted other probes. The most noteworthy one was in May of last year, May 2014, when they sent the drilling rig into waters claimed by the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese called them on it. We had a little sea war of shouting and water cannon and also ramming among fishing boats and patrol boats for about a month. The Vietnamese also said this was a step by China, a very calculated one, to try to reach the nine dash line. So that became, it's not a Hanoi is not afraid of getting in China's face. That's something that Jim and I can talk about a little bit later. We know that because at the 1979 border war, which the Vietnamese won over the Chinese, the Filipinos have gotten aggressive to a point that they've created a naval and military modernization program. We wrote a bit about that on the strategy page. It's pretty extensive. But it's no way can it compete with China, which is why the Filipinos want their old ally, the U.S., back in it, and they have been pushing us seriously for the last decade. They've wanted us back in, but they've really been pushing a serious U.S. seriously for the last decade to take a firmer stand in the South China Sea. The Vietnamese would love to have us as an ally. The Thais already do, even though the Thais are, dare I say it, tied up with their own internal problems right now, which we write about on strategy page. The Malaysians understand the Chinese threat. So do the Indonesians. And then, of course, there's Singapore, which understands the Chinese threat quite well. And if you look at where they're building these islands, you'd think, are they reaching for the Strait of Malacca? Well, that's one thing they could be doing. Sure. They've also got the inner chain of islands and the outer chain of islands, and you follow this in a number of publications that have been translated about Chinese naval strategy or littoral strategy or expansionary strategy in East Asia and Southeast Asia. So what came down to this week is the U.S., and we have been talking about this seriously. The U.S. Navy carrying the flag within the quote-unquote 12 nautical mile limit of territorial claims of two artificial islands that the Chinese have built in this area in the Spratly Islands. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter all but said we were going to do this in late May at a conference in Singapore, and the Chinese said what he said at the time was provocative and aggressive. The Navy, according to a report I read yesterday, came up with the plan for this cruise in June. I guarantee you that plan already existed. It's just a question of identifying the vessel and what the support elements were going to be. And my guess is, too, is that we told the Chinese definitely at the military-to-military level that before this is coming, because the Chinese had two ships that were shadowing the USS Lassen, and it was a demonstration that the United States will sail, guarantee freedom of navigation. The U.S. also, as part of its statement about this operation, said, we have no bone to pick about the sovereignty issue. That's for the littoral nations of Southeast Asia and China to settle among themselves, which is a good diplomatic tact to take, because that takes a little of the edge off of it. You know, we're not going to war over this, is what the U.S. statement says. And last thing I'll say is that Taiwan has got a rather interesting diplomatic proposal where it says, no, let's not talk about sovereignty, but let's just come up with a way for everybody to mutually develop resources and not spend so much money building military air bases in the South China Sea and creating artificial islands that all they do is exacerbate tensions and force nations to consider going to war, and it has forced that the Vietnamese and the Filipinos do not want to fight China by any means. China shouldn't want to fight them, but the Chinese have the Chinese now face the beginning of a anti-Chinese coalition in Southeast Asia, based with Singapore, Malaysia, probably Indonesia, Vietnam, and the Philippines, possibly Thailand, and South Korea and Japan are, even though they're on the Northeast Asia, South Korea and Vietnam now have some training and support agreements that were signed to send China a message, and Japan has decided that it can wage offensive warfare, sort of. That's the way it is right now, but they are set to do that. which is another warning to China. And part of this is their aggressive Beijing's aggressive push on sea claims, both vis-a-vis Japan and South Korea, as well as in the South China Sea. The U.S. has come down, and I think clearly the big message is, you know which side we're on. So, turn it over to Jim.
Okay. Jim?
Vietnam and China actually fought small battles, naval battles, in 1974 and 1988 over the disputed areas. In fact, one reason why they had the land battle in 1979 was the Chinese felt these Vietnamese were getting a little too uppity and needed to be taught a lesson. The lesson was mainly learned by China in that its forces were nowhere near ready for combat. They were severely thrashed. The naval battles were a little more, you know, even the Vietnamese never had much of a navy. The U.S. Navy saw to that. The Chinese also learned from 79, like in 88, they basically used overwhelming force. It's interesting that in the 90s, Vietnam started to very diligently get back in the good graces of the United States. And that's one reason why there hasn't been another naval battle between the Vietnamese and the Chinese. As Austin mentioned, there was an incident recently about oil drilling. The Chinese pulled back. In the past, they would have just called in the warships and told the Vietnamese to back off or get blown away. But now, you know, the Vietnamese have, you know, the United States as a quasi-ally, as well as the Russians, which is interesting since the Russians and Chinese are supposed to be fast friends. But the Russians are selling the Vietnamese 6 modern submarines and a lot of other weapons to boot. And, of course, the Vietnamese have invaded us back to use old Vietnam War-era naval bases, Kamon Bay, et cetera. And, you know, everybody's getting chummy as long as it involves opposition to Chinese aggression. The Chinese, of course, have a problem which they created themselves. One, they started all of this because the government in China, basically still a communist dictatorship. You have to keep reminding people of that. And the, you know, for example, the armed forces, they when they swear, you know, their oath of allegiance, it's to the Communist Party of China, not to China, which is something the Chinese picked up from Russia. Actually, they also had it during the, you know, the imperial era where you swore your loyalty to the emperor, not to, you know, China. And the government in China has been running into growing problems with its rapidly increasing middle class, which doesn't want to just, you know, kowtow and take orders from the emperor or commissar, whatever you want to call them these days. They want their freedom, and they want to be able to, you know, get rich, as Deng Xiaoping told them in the 1980s when he unleashed, you know, economic freedom, as it were, such as it was, and entrepreneurs. But the Chinese have a problem in that they need some way to distract the population from the domestic enemy, namely the communist government. And, of course, the classic way to do that is to create overseas, you know, external threats. Now, they had Japan, which they had not gone after Japan initially. You know, when they started the entrepreneur thing, Chinese told the Japanese, oh, let bygones be bygones. You know, hey, the United States nuked you. You know, let's call it a wash, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing was said officially, but the Japanese were eager to get the business, and the Chinese were eager to have somebody so close who was rich and industrialized and willing to build factories inside of China and basically transfer technology, manufacturing technology. So it wasn't until the last 10 years that the Chinese decided, oh, hey, those damn Japanese, didn't they kill 20 million of us during the Second World War? You know, it's as if the United States decided, oh, those damn Germans, you know, didn't they kill, you know, 50 million people during World War II? Shouldn't we get on the case for that? China, they do things differently in East Asia. You know, everybody understands the rules because they've been playing by them for, you know, over 2,000 years. They pay a lot more attention, as also pointed out, to history. You know, the classic Chinese strategy of making a claim, seeing how people react to it, and coming back. But there is one big difference. If the United States gets involved, and the Chinese have become more aggressive recently because they thought, you know, the current American government, you know, at least since 2004, has been, or 2003 actually, has been distracted by the war on terror. And then Obama, you know, a Democratic presidency came in, and they made it clear early on that they were not interested in getting involved in overseas ventures, as it were, including defending allies in the East Asia. And so the Chinese said, well, here's our opportunity, because China cannot afford to go to war with the United States. Now, I'm speaking not from the standpoint of China as all the Chinese people and the culture and the economy and what have you. I'm talking about the government. The Chinese government is on thin ice. They realize that unless they keep performing economically, that's their only justification. The Chinese people, despite government propaganda to the contrary, are well aware of what happened in 1989, not just Tiananmen Square, which was a direct outgrowth of what happened in Eastern Europe. All those communist governments collapsed. China has tried to officially erase that. You know, you don't learn about that in history. If you go to school, you know, grammar school and high school or college in China, you don't hear any of that. You hear another version, which we in the West wouldn't recognize. So again, it's an old Bolshevik, old, you know, something the Russians invented and has been used before. The ancient Egyptians, the archaeologists have found, carvings. That's why the Egyptians, would put the message up, with his paintings and what have you. Where one pharaoh didn't like what his predecessor did, so he went out and carved out, erased, etc. But with modern technology, you can see through and say, hey, there's a different story behind the one that, is most visible. So this is an old technique, but it doesn't work in the modern age. The ancient Egyptians didn't have the internet. And that is driving them nuts, because more and more Chinese are finding out, A, about what really went on in Eastern Europe and in Russia, which also lost its communist government, and how it happened. And they are talking about it. You're not supposed to. The Great Firewall of China, there are 2 million people who are involved in censoring the internet in China. They do pick up a lot of this before they squelch it. They know, oops, we found another incidence of talking about this or talking about that. The Chinese, senior Chinese government officials get these reports, these summaries, and they note that, my God, people are still talking about the thing we fear the most. And they also talk about, if these bastards weren't allowing us to get rich, we just go out there and just give them the old heave-ho. I mean, people are literally talking about, we need another revolution, which reminds me of a joke in Russia in the late 70s, early 80s. This joke was very prominent in Russia, and it was about Leonid Brezhnev, one of the last and most corrupt of the leaders of Russia, famous for his lavish lifestyle and for a servant of the people. And his mother comes to visit him, and Leonid Brezhnev shows off his palaces, his automobile collection, the paintings he has and whatnot. And then his mother shakes her head and nods. And finally, Leonid says, well, Mama, what do you think? And she looks at him and says, what if the Reds come back? So, this is what the Chinese are also worried about. They know what happened in Russia. People just decided, we've had enough. We're through with you guys. Screw you. And bingo. And it was the same thing that happened in Eastern Europe. The dragon had no fire, as it were. They blinked. And the Chinese government is well aware of the fact that the corruption, which is rampant in the police and the security forces, both the armed forces and the police, but especially in the police, and is a major source of popular, anger at the government. And they're having a heavy, I mean, they are trying to suppress the corruption, but it's endemic. The Chinese had problems with police forces are rather recent development in China, but the military's been around for thousands of years, and they've always had. I mean, written Chinese history that has come down to us is full of accounts of massive corruption with the military. But the Mongols, if somebody decides to invade again, they're supposed to have a million crossbows, stored away in the armories, which is how they could defeat them. They'd call out a million peasants, take a few days to show them how to use a crossbow, and then they could usually defeat most enemies. Well, they found out the crossbows weren't there. Most of them had fallen apart, and where had the money gone? It was the same old story, and it's happening again, and China realizes that if the economy tanks, in other words, if they're cut off from overseas trade, with stuff coming in, raw materials coming in, and manufactured goods going out, they'll have massive unemployment and disruption in the economy. And that will give people ideas that the Chinese, government realizes are not good for them. So all this posturing with the United States about we're going to basically go to war with you if you don't, go along with our land grab in the South China Sea is all smoke and mirrors. They cannot afford it. Now, we know it. They know it. But they thought our current government would simply keep backing off, falling for the dog and pony show the Chinese put on. But apparently somebody in Washington eventually they got through and said, hey, no, this is out of the ancient Chinese playbook. All you got to do is push, stand fast, and they will back off. They cannot afford to push back. Now, people say, well, that might lead to war. But who can afford, war the least? The Chinese. If the Chinese attack us, which they would have to do, what do you think would be the reaction on both sides? In China, there might be an initial enthusiasm, let's teach those Weizhou bastards, a lesson or two. But in the United States, you know, goes back to World War II. Hey, you know, we're just trying to keep the sea lanes open, trying to, you know, back our allies in preventing China from stealing their territory. You know, we're on the side of the angels, you know, so screw you guys. And the Chinese experts on the West, and they need those experts because the Chinese take a very Chinese-centric view of the world, which is not unusual. But, you know, these are guys who never have – it's the business community which deals a lot with Westerners. It's not the senior people in the Chinese government. And they basically have to be told and reminded, you know, these strange-looking, smelly, big-nosed, round-eyed, you know, barbarians, they don't think like us. They don't react like us. And, you know, and it's not like the enemies, the northern barbarians, the Mongols and dozens of others, the Manchus and what have you. The normal rules of strategy may not or probably will not play out as we expected. Now, the Japanese, we were aware of this, made the same mistake. Again, because there's some from the same general culture. You know, hit them hard enough initially, and they'll back up and sue for peace. Well, you know, the Westerners don't play by those rules. And the Chinese have to be reminded by their experts, but the Chinese leadership is under tremendous pressure because of the local corruption, the growing unrest. I mean, one thing that gets into the news in the United States is the fall in the Chinese stock market, which was artificial because the Chinese government, desperate, you know, for another feel-good, you know, event, last year, they basically loosened up. What they basically did was what caused our stock market crash in 1929. They allowed people to borrow more money more easily to buy more stock, so the stock market would boost, and everybody get, you know, could at least feel rich because they had, you know, funny money on their brokerage account, and that blew up in their faces, and they're still trying to deal with that. And the problem is China. Knows how to run China. The Chinese rulers know how to run China by traditional Chinese rules, and it works. They don't know how to deal with a lot of the modern technology, like stock markets. No emperor ever had to deal with that before. Or with, you know, these Western barbarians. Because, you know, in the 19th century, they dealt with them somewhat, but not as the Chinese got the real lesson, and the Japanese got the real lesson. The hard way, the Black Fleet, that opened the opening of China, the American fleet, who worships sailing into Tokyo Bay and saying, "Hey, trade or else." That made more of an impression on the Japanese than similar incidences, you know, down in Hong Kong and what have you, made on China. China was a much larger empire. They didn't really feel the pain the way the Japanese did, so they didn't learn. And of course, through most of the 20th century, China depended upon America as an ally. They needed all the allies they could get, and the United States was there. But now the situation has changed, and they're trying to play rough at the United States, and they don't know what rules to play by.
So, Dan, I got a couple of comments on that. It was a fascinating discussion about China's issues with dealing with the world. And Jim, I hope the listeners know they got a flavor of what a China-centric view is like, and a lot of that is playing out with what we're seeing in the South China Sea. This is tangential to it, but it's Jim's point about the knowledge class or the technocrats or the not necessarily out of the technocrats and the educated, but those who can Chinese who can access the internet and find not only alternative explanations but historical facts that totally dispute the empty areas or fill in the empty areas of the missing history. There are plenty of Chinese. And again, it's going to sound like I'm talking about "quote unquote," the educated intellectuals. They understand this very well because they were anathematized during the Cultural Revolution. But the Cultural Revolution, which was engineered by Mao, was considered to be non-Chinese or un-Chinese. I'm not sure the way to word it, to attack learning, to attack intellectuals, to attack the artists and the accomplished. But it did. And even though that's now receding rapidly into the past, 45 years ago, 50 years ago, 40, that's a scar. And that predates 1989 and Tiananmen Square. So the Communist Party is aware that it carries that burden, not necessarily with now the now aging or long dead intellectuals that it attacks in the Cultural Revolution, and technocrats too, I should say. Some of the people that were very useful in Deng Xiaoping's revitalization of the Chinese economy were survivors of the Cultural Revolution. But that's another source of internal animus. It may not show up, but it's in discussion often, but it's remembered and it is acknowledged, and the technocrats and intellectuals know that the Communist Party could turn on them again. Now, I just mentioned that. How does that relate to the South China Sea? I said it was tangential, but it does speak to what Jim said about some of China's many internal problems. You could say, and I've read this. I don't know whether how true it is or not. Jim may have an opinion on it, that some of these folks who were, or the sons and daughters of the people who suffered the Cultural Revolution, are part of the groups that were bought off by the "you can get rich now" statement by Deng Xiaoping. Okay, we'll get rich now and we'll forget about it. But it's not forgotten, and it still plays a political role. One other comment that I will say about the South China Sea expedition of the Lassen is the Navy's got to follow up with it. As Jim said, since really 2003, let's say that with the Iraq operation, the U.S. has been tied up with other in other areas of the world, reluctance by the Obama administration to get involved in quote-unquote foreign entanglements. But now this has been done. Navy needs to keep sailing through those disputed waters with the same calm resolve that the Lassen did this week. I read this. And I'm not someone who gives a lot of credit to quote unquote personal diplomacy, even though there are examples of it working. Here's an example of when it didn't work. The report, and I read this in several places, including the New York Times, that China's president and President Obama met in late September at an informal White House meeting, and the South China Sea was discussed. And the Chinese the Chinese were not cooperative on finding a diplomatic solution to their shenanigans in the South China Sea. So there may have been a very high level, I mean, that's what the rumor is, discussion that finally said, here's the go, we're going to go ahead and do it. We've been saying we were going to do it. And as I said earlier, Dan, and Jim commented on this, the Filipinos are very much behind this, and then the Singaporeans and Malaysians are behind this. We know the Vietnamese are, but the Malaysians and Filipinos and Singaporeans are definitely U.S. U.S. allies, and they say they deserve the backup. That's, to put it in a Filipino-centric point of view, we have earned the right to have you back us up, and I say that despite all the disputes that the U.S. and the Philippines have had. That's part of where their political view, and I think that they've got a legitimate, the Filipinos have a legitimate point. The Singaporeans say if they're heading towards us, you need to act because we've been a good ally to the United States. We give you berthing rights to essentially Singapore operates as a quasi-U.S. Naval base. And if you're going to have those kind of relationships. As the big boy, you got to step up. So this was when the big boy stepped up.
Jim, how's this all going to play out over the next couple of years?
Well, if we keep blocking, you know, Chinese efforts to create these artificial islands and declare them part of China, Chinese won't be going to back off. I mean, as Austin pointed out, the Chinese, you know, take a long view. That's their traditional strategy. And if they have an enemy, a foe, whatever you want to call us, who seems to be, you know, too powerful, and it's mainly our economy, they will say, well, all right, we have to create another foreign enemy. Let's go back and beat on the Japanese again or whatever. The Chinese also are using their economic power, which is somewhat, you know, damaged at the moment, but it'll come back. And that's, as Austin mentioned, they're big in Cambodia because Cambodia is still run by the successors of the communist, radical communist, government that the Vietnamese, put down in the 1970s. Another reason why China is angry at them. They basically see China as their protector. So they willingly, go along with China. Burma, on the other hand, which China has been spending even more money on, developing the northern tribal areas, the Burmese would much rather be allies with the West or even India. And they've been backing away from China. But Chinese will keep at it. I mean, they take the long view. And they realize they have a lot more money than they had, 20, 30 years ago. And they are deploying it, not just for profit, but for foreign affairs. And so they feel in the long term, it's their backyard. They are the big dog, in that neighborhood. And eventually they'll prevail. And that's something you can't do much about. I mean, in the short term, we'll get them to back off. In the long term, they have the edge.
Well, the U.S. really isn't China's enemy. The U.S. doesn't conceive of itself as that. And the sense is that most Chinese don't see the U.S. as an enemy either. If they're emotionally charged, the Vietnamese and the Japanese are their enemies. Maybe the Russians, but the Chinese Communist Party and the hardcore in that has a lot of enemies. Some of them real, some of them imagined. Dan, and as Jim says, one day the United States could be their enemy. The next day, somebody else, and it's a matter of them that putting their survival first and not the good of China. Have you heard that story before of a government, authoritarian government clique more concerned about itself than the country? All the time.
Yeah. All the time. Well, we'll end it there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Indeed.
Bye.
Take care.